I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 12,768. That's how many ads Mitt Romney and pro-Romney super PACs have aired in Florida. The number of ads from Newt Gingrich and his super PACs, just 210. And those latest numbers from the Wesleyan Media Project don't even include this past weekend. Romney's lead going into today's primary might indicate his ad assault worked, but at least one voter, Pat Curry, heading to the polls in Pensacola, was not happy about any ads.
I really don't like them. Some of them are downright disgusting to me, you know, because you have to watch them over and over and over.
Michael Hunt and Laura Harris said they cast their ballots today based on candidates' values.
Personal values. Someone that's not going to be the same. I feel like some of them are in it for themselves and for their profitable gains. Just looking for somebody that's there to serve the public, which it should be.
I don't think you can always agree with one person on every issue. So perhaps whoever has the most idealism that I agree with.
Thanks to our friends at WWF in Pensacola for that sound. As we touch down in Florida today with Sergio Bustos, politics editor for the Miami Herald. And Sergio, almost 13,000 ads from one candidate, 200 from the other. How did that feel there?
Well, let me share with you an anecdote, Robin. There's a influential Spanish-language radio station down in Miami here called Radio Mambí. They actually apologized to listeners because they had to shorten their actual programming to fit all the ads in. That's how bad it got.
So taking programming off the air to fit the ads.
Yes.
Well, and what's been the reaction? Because we saw Mitt Romney's huge surge at the end of last week. A lot are attributing it to his attacks, especially through these thousands of ads. But, you know, it's odd because voters are saying they didn't like the ads.
Let me put it this way. With Iowa, you had the town hall meetings and the handshakes. With New Hampshire, you had the same. Florida's a different animal altogether. 10 major media markets, you need lots of money, and you need momentum. Newt Gingrich had momentum coming in, but he didn't have the money. Mitt Romney had the money coming in, he just didn't have the momentum. But those ads, despite what people say, I know they hate the negative ads, but they are very effective.
Well, here's the latest numbers. The Gingrich campaign and the pro-Gingrich super PAC Winning Our Future spent $3.3 million on TV ads in Florida. That's compared to $15 million from the Romney campaign and his super PAC Restore Our Future. So Floridians are getting to feel the results of the Supreme Court decision on spending on campaign ads. What else are they saying as they're going to the polls?
People are fed up. They're fed up with high unemployment. It's much higher here than the rest of the country. 44% of Floridians with a mortgage are underwater in the mortgage, including the person you're talking to. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of frustration in Florida. And I thought when Newt Gingrich came down, he was expressing some of that. But it looked like that message didn't resonate enough, and he didn't have really a plan to resolve the job situation or the housing problem. He came into the state with a good message, but he just couldn't really dig deeper and tell us what he would do about it.
Well, Newt Gingrich still says, in fact, he tells ABC's Jonathan Carl today that this primary race could go another 6 to 8 months. And part of the reason could be the delegate count. Now, just remind us, Florida moved its primary day up. We remember the spat, you know, last fall, and was punished by the Republican Party for it. So how will that affect the outcome of this race?
Yes, they paid the price. Florida now has just 50 delegates.
Instead of like 99, I think it was.
Exactly. Yeah. Florida doesn't seem to mind much because they wanted to get on the national stage, and they certainly did it with this by moving up the primary.
Well, so there could still be a delegate fight as these candidates continue on to the convention.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we thought we would be part of the mix, but now it looks like the campaign's going to roll on Super Tuesday in March, which I think is about 10 states. So that may settle the nomination finally. But who knows? You know, it's been a very strange race so far.
And Sergio Bustos, what do the candidates leave behind them? We're hearing Republican analysts say this is one of the nastiest fights they've seen in a long time. And they cite, you know, George W. Bush and John McCain in South Carolina, for instance, as another example.
Publicly, GOP officials will say, look, this is good, a hearty debate going back and forth. We'll unite as a party later. But I think there's no doubt there's going to be some damage because If you're inside the Barack campaign brainstorming session on advertising, you don't have to look further than Florida. There's plenty of ideas on how to attack either Gingrich or Romney.
By taking some of the attacks they launched against
exactly.
each other. Sergio Bustos, politics editor for the Miami Herald, thanks so much.
Sure.
Okay, we need to give you a heads up because we want to take a look today at a topic, aspects of which are horrifying, but there is no other way to tell the story of the latest wave of methamphetamine reports. Methamphetamine has become the single biggest drug threat in parts of the country, including the Central Valley of California. And the latest headlines involve mothers who either kill or try to kill their children. In Fresno, California, 23-year-old Aida Mendez is accused of shooting her toddlers and a cousin, seriously wounding her husband. A Bakersfield, California mother was sentenced this month for stabbing her newborn. An Oklahoma woman, and this is the horrifying part, put her infant in a washing machine, killing her. Why is this happening? In the coming days, we're going to look at a new method of making the drug that has produced so many burn victims that burn units in some hospitals are closing down because they can't handle the load. But today, let's put meth addiction in context with Dr. Alex Stalkup. He's founder of the New Leaf Treatment Center in Lafayette, California. He's received some federal funding to do research into meth addiction. Dr. Stalkup, welcome.
Thank you.
And we remember a spate of reports of people using this drug and, you know, perhaps their face would become aged beyond their years. We heard of labs that make the drug blowing up and burning down homes. But why are mothers killing their children? What does this drug do to them?
I mean, simply put, those mothers are not in their right mind. The drug has taken them over, taken over their lives. If you look at the way that meth works on the brain, it is a drug that leads to violence very readily. At worst, some of them have used enough that they've actually developed a condition which is indistinguishable from paranoid schizophrenia. They are delusional, they hallucinate, and many of you have seen those scratch marks and dig marks on the skin of the arm and the face. That's a true hallucination, that bugs are crawling on the skin. And they also lose the ability to speak coherently. So they're very much in easily one of the most dramatically altered states of mind I've ever seen. And I've been working with people in altered states of consciousness for 30 years, and I've never seen anything like this.
Well, you work with heroin addicts, so you're saying this is far worse than that?
Far worse, in the sense that opiate addicts, when they're high, are docile. They're only dangerous when they're coming down and start to get sick. Meth inherently generates anger, irritability, and rage. And a big problem with most people who use meth, especially if they're smoking the drug, which concentrates the high, a big problem for those people is they can't sleep. Let me ask you a question, Robin. How are you after 7 or 8 days of no sleep, period?
Ask the people I work with. Not pleasant.
It's awful, and, yeah. And yet that's the norm. Even in the early days of meth smoking, people will be up for 2 or 3 days, then they'll crash for a day or two, and as you can imagine, when you're high or when you're crashing, you can't take care of your five-year-old.
Well, we understand the stimulant effect of methamphetamine is up to 50 times longer than cocaine, so as you said, people are staying awake for days on end. Paranoia sets in. I mean, that some of these mothers literally think that these infants are, you know, some part of a plot to get them.
It's crazy thinking. Their minds are racing 1,000 miles an hour. They're hypersensitive, hyperactive, and the least bit of stimulus can set them off. The thing that upsets me the most is that we really, really do have effective treatment for methamphetamine addiction. It's just not available.
What is it? What's the treatment?
The federal government funded 9 treatment sites around the United States to study how to treat methamphetamine addiction. And we can now report rates of 2 out of 3 people clean fully a year after treatment.
Wait a minute. That's an astonishing rate for any addict. You couldn't get that success rate with an alcoholic. So
no, you couldn't. It's actually more treatable than most of the addictions. Addiction's a chronic disease. Getting 2 out of 3 clean a year after treatment is about as well as we do treating people with high blood pressure or high lipids. We have good treatment. unfortunately, it's not available, and people are dying, and their families are in trouble, and they get crazy, and they hurt people.
So explain further, why isn't it available? You say there were treatment centers around the country. Are they just not where the addicts are?
Well, I think part of it's a maldistribution of resources. Most drug treatment resources go to large urban areas. Methamphetamine, as in the state we're currently in, is predominantly a rural drug epidemic.
Why is that? Because we mentioned the valley in California. Why is that such a capital?
In the olden days, after World War II, meth came back with returning troops and quickly became the province of outlaw motorcycle gangs. Around 1980, a new cooking technique emerged, and it changed the way the drug can be used. The old-fashioned drug, crank, you could use it by snorting it, and you could use it by intravenous injection, but you couldn't smoke it. Now, when a drug becomes smokable, the high is concentrated dramatically.
Isn't that also where you get the huge danger of the fire and the burning and such?
Well, yeah, you got it right. You remember Richard Pryor blew his face off smoking cocaine. But the high is extraordinary. It's been compared by the many people I see every day to 10, 20, 30 orgasms going off in your head at the same time. However, that level of elation and euphoria is very dangerous because it injures the brain. It deafens the brain's ability to experience normal pleasure. And once you stop, you don't go back to normal. You go as low as you had been high. Let me tell you, from watching these folks, it's unimaginably bad. Now, the problem is that powerful a drug activates the fight or flight system of the body. So as the euphoria wears off, the user is left with the sensation that they're in great threat, and they begin to believe, in fact, that they are in danger, that people are following them. A man came in yesterday morning bringing in several sheets of license plate numbers because he believed he was being followed on the freeway by green vans. He pulled over and wrote the license number of all the green vans, brought it into me proudly to prove to me that, in fact, he was being followed. Well, I mean, obviously, that's a paranoid delusion. He believed it with all his heart.
We're talking with Dr. Alex Stalkup, founder of the New Leaf Treatment Center in Lafayette, California. Dr. Stalkup, you mentioned before the break that meth came to the U.S. with troops after World War II. It was picked up by motorcycle gangs. Now it's in the hands of farmhands in California and super labs that are controlled by Mexican drug trafficking organizations. But meth, which is made from, you know, other pharmacy drugs, has historically come over the border from Mexico.
Yeah, it was then and it is now, although a lot of the meth that's on the streets is homemade.
But we understand another appeal of these farmland areas is they're isolated. There's shacks, out in isolated areas where people can either sell or make the drug. But also people in the area, it's just become so potent in the Central Valley that meth-related robberies are through the roof, people stealing manhole covers, agricultural plumbing, copper wiring, lawn sprinklers, things to sell to get money.
You got it right.
And by the way, we mentioned stealing manhole covers. I mean, there was a report of a woman who fell through a hole in the ground because somebody had stolen the manhole cover to sell. You can really feel this drug in your area.
It is. It's a menace. It's like a dark cloud. People get trapped in the drug life. And you actually raise a good point. Not only do people take desperate measures like stealing trivial things, turning them into dope, the main obstacle, and in fact the biggest obstacle to someone getting off of meth, they have to get away from the drug. So if you look at the small towns that are heavily, heavily impacted by methamphetamine, boy, it's hard to get away from your neighbors, church-going friends, people at the PTA. So in these little towns, the main thing that's necessary to get off meth is the hardest to achieve.
Well, and I would imagine this is particularly difficult if you're in a farming community and this
that's
is what you
point.
Do. Yeah,
that's my point.
Yeah.
I mean, every time you turn around, you see somebody out of their mind spun on meth, and it instantly triggers extreme hunger for the drug.
By the way, do I read that your phrase for this idea that, you know, you have to be in the area because that's where your work is, and so you're constantly subjected to the drug use, environmental cueing?
That's the problem. 50% of relapses to meth occur because the drug entered their environment. It also challenges the current practice of sending somebody to another county, another state to get treatment. It's all worthless if they return and encounter the drug. They'll relapse as soon as they're around the drug. This is built into the biology of methamphetamine. It creates drug hunger when it's around you.
Well, Dr. Stelkup, we talk about the treatment, the idea that treatment centers have been set up, but you say it's not enough, and this is so doubly tragic because the treatment works. What is the treatment?
The treatment involves, number one, getting away from the drug. Secondly, treating the horrible, horrible symptoms that arise when you initiate abstinence. Pitiful depression, levels of anxiety, insomnia. We treat those with medicine. Mm-hmm. We really try and calm them down and keep the agitation at a minimum. Many, many of these people will have an underlying mental illness, and even if they didn't, the drug will produce mental illness. That has to be treated. Because what a lot of patients experience is, okay, they fought the fight, they got sober, now they can't stop weeping, and they want to kill themselves. And they rush back to the drug because they simply can't stand how they feel.
So I just want to ask you, because a lot of this sounds familiar when we've talked about other addiction treatments, and I keep going back to alcohol. It sounds familiar, but then you've said that if you can get someone away from the environment, get this medication to help them, you know, detox, that you have this huge success rate, 2 out of 3. That's a huge.
It is. It's wonderful.
Huge. So are you saying that as devastating as methamphetamine is for the brain, it actually sounds as if you can change the environment, you have a better chance of becoming sober, if you will, than even alcoholics do?
Yes, they do. I mean, alcoholics can't be around alcohol either. But the potency of meth is such that they just are uniquely vulnerable to the presence of the drug in the environment. And that's a big problem in rural areas, as we said.
And as you said, perhaps uniquely able to succeed if you can get them out of the environment.
Or clean up the environment. And so we'll often, if a lady comes in and she's meth addicted, she's worried about how she's treating her kids, we'll bring the old man in who's also a user. If we can get them both to get some clean time, I mean, it really helps. It's sort of black or white. If one's using and the other one's sober, they'll both use. If one's sober and the other one stops using, they'll both progress to sobriety. Mm-hmm. It's a family disease.
This must break your heart, Dr. Stelkup.
It does. But, you know, at the same time it breaks my heart, you're talking to one of the most optimistic people around because I see people get well all the time. It isn't a slam dunk. It's so hard. They don't want to be drug addicts. They don't want to mistreat their children. They want to be healthy. They can't get any traction as long as someone's puffing on the pipe around them.
One last question. Just these stunning headlines that we started with, wrenching of mothers using methamphetamine and now accused of either trying to or succeeding in killing their infants. Is this new?
No, I mean, meth violence goes all the way back to when we first began seeing it in the 80s.
But I mean, is it new for so many women?
No. Unlike most drugs, which has about 2 men for every woman, this is an equal opportunity drug, and men and women use it equally. Many of them are parenting women. And in fact, in the early days of meth, it's all big party time. You know, you feel like you're the best mom in the world. As soon as you start to come down, you're hell on wheels. So put yourself in the frame of a 5-year-old. 1 minute, she's mother of the year, huggy kissy, she's high. As she starts to come down, right before the kid's eyes, she turns mean. She hurts the kid. She cusses the kid out. Kids can grow up in bad environments, but they can't grow up in environments that switch that quickly.
Dr. Alex Stelkup, founder of the New Leaf Treatment Center in Lafayette, California, talking to us about the methamphetamine problems that are being dealt with out there in California. Dr. Stelkup, thanks so much.
Thank you. I'm grateful for the chance to let people know about this.
Israeli officials say they believe time is running out for a military strike to stop Iran's nuclear program because Iran is moving more of its facilities deeper underground. But from Iran, a conciliatory gesture, an invitation to UN nuclear inspectors to stay beyond their planned 3 days. The inspectors say they will end their mission today as planned. In the background, the European Union votes to stop buying Iranian oil, and the U.S. tightens sanctions on Iran's central bank, hampering the country's ability to sell oil. Iran retaliated with a threat to block the Strait of Hormuz, which carries about a fifth of the world's oil every day. So how is this resonating in Iran? Thomas Erdbrink covers Iran for The Washington Post. He's in Tehran. Thomas, you say the sanctions have led to high inflation and a drop in Iran's currency. How is this being felt in Iran?
This has placed fear in the hearts of at least of people here in Tehran, and you can see that they fear that the currency will collapse even further, so therefore they are investing in things that keep their value. Today I was out on the streets in front of Bank Mehli, Iran's main bank, and people were lining up to buy cheaper gold coins. I visited the foreign currency bazaar. People were trying to buy dollars everywhere. So the sanctions are having a serious effect here. The sanctions are also amplifying bad economical measures made by Iran's leaders in the past.
I'm reading about a merchant that you write about who says that he absolutely believes that this is all leading to war and that his family, his friends, they're all desperate.
Yeah, people are very desperate, and there is a very big sense of hopelessness in the country. Iran's leaders are trying to give it a positive spin. They say this is a tough time. They compare it to the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s, in which Iran was under huge pressure. And they're making a lot of comparisons with this time. They tell me off the record, look, we've gone through bad times. We've been under sanctions for 30 years. We can survive. But for normal people, who especially in the last 10 years have gotten used to huge oil windfall, a large rise of the standard of living, people started traveling, people started watching satellite TV, people started going on Facebook and connected to the outside world, they now have a feeling that they're being thrown back into the past, and they feel that there is no solution from either their government or the American government to solve these deep problems that are only causing sanction upon sanction upon sanction and possibly even war.
But yet you write that on the other side of the fence, officials you speak to in Washington and other Western capitals don't share this sense of impending confrontation, you know, that this is necessarily leading to war, that in fact they express some cautious satisfaction that the policies are working. Working towards what end?
Well, this is, of course, the big question that normal Iranians also have. Is it the West's aim to prevent Iran's leaders from making a nuclear weapon, or is it the West's aim to overthrow the Iranian leadership? People here, at least, are getting more and more the feeling that even if the nuclear case will be solved, the pressure will probably continue. And that kind of explains their hopelessness, the stories they're telling me. People are stocking up on rice, people are stocking up on meat. Some people are thinking that if the war breaks out, we will go to our holiday homes around the Caspian Sea. It's all theory still, but the fear is there.
Well, Thomas Erdbrink, you're also writing that you are detecting that the Iranian government, while acting belligerent, is also signaling some negotiation. We heard this extended invitation to the inspectors to stay longer. So are you picking up that there may be some sense of negotiating over the nuclear program?
Well, the Iranians, at least the people around President Ahmadinejad, are clearly giving the signal that they want to talk. The problem is it's unclear what they are willing to put on the table. I spoke with an advisor to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei today, and he said, you should compare the situation to a fight with your neighbor. Your neighbor comes to you and complains about everything, whereas you are perfectly innocent and not slamming the doors or making too much noise. This is the relation we have with the Americans. They are accusing us of things that we are not doing, so therefore we don't need to make a compromise. So the Iranians are willing to enter negotiations, but at this point it is not clear if they have any compromise to give.
Thomas Erdbrink, Iran correspondent for The Washington Post in Tehran. Thomas, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
A flood of robocalls, those recorded messages from presidential candidates and their supporters, is continuing in Florida today. Sarah Palin's husband, Todd, recorded a robocall for Newt Gingrich, and the Gingrich campaign sent out this robocall attacking Mitt Romney.
As governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney vetoed a bill paying for kosher food for our seniors in nursing homes. Holocaust survivors, who for the first time were forced to eat non-kosher because Romney thought $5 was too much to pay for our grandparents to eat kosher.
Well, by the way, fact checkers debunked that claim, as they did many claims in Mitt Romney's calls in South Carolina. Mitt Romney made as many as 10 robocalls a day. Political robocalls are exempt from the national Do Not Call registry, and unlike some other states, Florida has no law banning them. But there is something called reverse robocalling. You can pay to send one. We'll hear about that from its creator, robocall expert Sean Dakin, who also runs something he calls the National Political Do Not Contact Registry. Voters can sign up on that for free, but none of the presidential candidates have indicated that they will agree to not call you, so it's largely symbolic. But Sean, first of all, give us the snapshot on robocalls. Are they effective? Are there more? Why do campaigns do them?
To be very quick and short, campaigns use them because they can, because they're exempt from the law. The Pew Center did research over the last couple of years, and in 2008, about 49-50% of the American electorate received robocalls. By 2010, that number had increased to about 69%. And the answer to whether they're effective is no, they're totally not effective. In fact, there are some professors up at Columbia and Yale University that have been studying political communications for about 15 years now, and they've determined that robocalls have a perfect record of never having worked.
Really? I mean,
because
we hear the phrases, they're efficient but not effective. So they're efficient and they're cheap, do we understand?
They're so cheap and so easy to do that more and more politicians do them, from everybody running from dog catcher up to president of the United States. So you could call 800,000 voters for about $2,000.
So cheap, efficient, but as you said, they don't seem to be effective, at least in research. And just anecdotally, you're saying in South Carolina, we mentioned how many robocalls Mitt Romney used, it might have even turned people off.
Yeah, exactly. My members, you know, over 350,000 members, write to me every day about how much they hate these things and how much they won't vote for politicians who won't respect their privacy. The only reason why people do them, politicians do them, is because consultants tell them to do them, and consultants make money doing them.
Yeah. Well, and we've mentioned Mitt Romney. We should mention Newt Gingrich has been using them, maybe not as targeted in one state, but he's been using them across the country in a method, a robocalling method called spraying and praying. What is that?
Yes, robocalls, you know, the story around robocalls is that they're often used by underfunded candidates. And so actually for months now, I've been getting reports from people getting robocalls from Newt Gingrich all over the country, Democrats and Republicans. This really, really long robocall that's about 2 minutes long. And then it does a transfer over to a live fundraiser. And that is an example of something that is hardly ever done in terms of using robocalls for fundraising.
Well, we mentioned that in some states it's banned. Indiana, Minnesota don't allow robocalls and enforce the law. In South Carolina, it's very confusing. There's a ban on the books, but the attorney general said robocall messages were legal. Now, what he means is he's making a distinction. If a message gets left, it's legal. But if a resident answers the phone, it's not. And so that's why you hear people, you know, hanging up, automatic machines hanging up if you answer, because that's not legal.
Right, which of course is particularly useless. The phone is ringing, people are getting up, going across the room, babies are being awoken, senior citizens are being confused. You know, whether there's somebody actually talking on the other end of the phone doesn't matter. The harm has happened when the phone is wrong.
Right, right. You enable people to sign up for a Do Not Contact registry, but you also enable citizens to do some robocalls of their own. So how do you enable somebody, let's say, to respond to a Mitt Romney or a Newt Gingrich?
Well, if they get too many of these calls and they want to respond to them, they would go to reverserobocall.com. They would select, in this case, let's say Mitt Romney. Then you would put in your phone number. The system calls you. You record a voice message. You then send that robocall yourself to one or hundreds of politicians. Making a call to a candidate, it's about 99 cents. Mm-hmm. Some people really want to call all of Congress, so you can call all of Congress, but that is going to cost a little bit more. So if you want to call all of Congress for 535 members and each one of their district offices, it's about 1,800 phone calls. That's more like, I think it's about $89 to do that. And mm-hmm. we've had a bunch of people who've done that. They're particularly interested in contacting all of Congress.
Well, so wait a second, Sean Dakin. So you are using the very thing that you hate it when politicians use it for you, but you're enabling people to use it on politicians.
Exactly, exactly. So if you can't beat them, you join them. Now, we do what we think is kind of model behavior, right? So we're not calling cell phones. Politicians can call cell phones. We're not calling at dinner time. We're only calling during business hours, and we're only calling main numbers. Many people say, oh, this is great. You know, tell me when you get their cell phone numbers and their home phone numbers so I can record a call to them. And we're like, well, that would be great in terms of getting revenge, but not something we want to do from a long-term perspective.
Just briefly, of all the things that happened during campaigns, why did this one bug you, obviously, so much that you decided to do this?
The funny story is that in 2004, I was actually working for the Kerry Edwards campaign, and we were sent to Cleveland, Ohio. And so I personally was making volunteer phone calls, not robocalls, just volunteer phone calls in a phone bank room. And I started calling people about 2 days ahead of the election, and they started saying things like, I am going to vote for George Bush because you're calling for John Kerry, and we're sick and tired of being interrupted at dinner. And so I put down the phone, talked to some other people. They all said they were getting similar responses from people who actually answered the phone. And so I essentially said, I think we're doing more harm than good. I'm not going to be making any more phone calls personally. And so a bunch of us said, hey, you know, this is not working. Let's go do something else. And we went to have a beer, and John Kerry lost the election. So.
And the rest is political history. Sean Dakin went from there to found the website Stop Political Calls, the National Political Do Not Contact Registry, which candidates can or cannot listen to. That's a nonprofit. He also created ReverseRobocall.com, a for-profit where you can make your own robocall. For more, go to HereNow.org. Sean Dakin, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
There's a land that I see where the children are free, and I say,
before the curtain rises on God of Carnage at the Huntington Theater here in Boston, the audience is treated to a medley of children's songs ending with Free to Be You and Me. And that kumbaya feeling carries over into the first scene. Two sets of parents meet to resolve a playground dispute. One of their sons hit another with a stick and broke his teeth. But thank goodness, as the victim's mother says, we're also civilized.
Fortunately, there is still such a thing as the art of coexistence, isn't there?
Which the children don't appear to have mastered. At least not ours.
Yes, not ours. What is going to happen to the tooth with the affected nerve?
We don't know yet. They're being cautious with the prognosis. Apparently the nerve hasn't been totally exposed.
The same can be said of the parents' nerves, but they will be rubbed raw and bleeding by the end as fights over proper parenting escalate into outright mayhem, the parents ultimately behaving worse than their children.
Welcome.
After the performance, I had a chance to sit down on stage as the actors came out for a Q&A. They all agreed how interesting it was that the play, written by French playwright Yasmina Reza and translated into English by British playwright Christopher Hampton, resonated so in the U.S. It had a hugely successful run on Broadway in 2009. It's just been released as a film. At the Huntington, one set of parents is played by Christy Puz and Brooks Asmanchkas, another by Stephen Bogardus and Johanna Day. How physical are the roles? Well, a recent performance had to be canceled when Johanna broke her hand punching her stage husband, Stephen.
She was in a lot of pain. You could tell.
Yeah, it was rough.
We immediately knew she was injured, and there's 15 more minutes of the play to do, and she didn't start crying until the end of the play.
Then there is Christy Puz's character, the mom, Annette, who, and sorry, there's no delicate way to say this, throws up all over Johanna's character's fine coffee table art books.
It's tubing that is built into my... I have a really attractive nude bodysuit that has a tube built into it that loops down my back. And when we're sitting on the couch, Brooks actually unhooks it and hooks me into the couch, which is actually a giant vomit machine.
There's
a huge...
So fake vomit is one obstacle. There's also spilled water, a treacherous wooden staircase. What kind of parents would have that? And then there's the dialogue.
What you're doing over the course of the evening, it's been compared to a ferocious tennis match that you can't miss a beat. And in watching it, I thought, you know, you really can. Another thing I saw is that each of you has pretty much 25% of the evening, which is kind of extraordinary. You know, it's an absolute ensemble. Mm-hmm. But if one of you misses that throw or hits that, doesn't hit it back right, it's, comment on it, it's off, right?
Yeah, it stinks.
Annette, what? You think my son is a snitch?
I don't think anything.
If you don't think anything, don't say anything. Stop making these insinuations.
Try to stay calm, Annette. Michael and I are making an effort to be reasonable and moderate.
The dialogue's a nightmare.
It is, truly. Because it comes so fast?
Because it's so specific, and it's, you know, it's translated by a British person from the French. So it's very British.
If we
wanted to do a run-through or try it once just in a British accent, and we sort of did a section of it once, and it was wildly easy.
Yeah, but because you mean it doesn't come as... you don't feel it's as organic. It doesn't come as naturally as you...
It's
as
very
it
stylized. But yeah. So I don't mean it's awful. It's just it's very difficult to speak.
But as we said, the issues talked about are universal. Take this scene where the four parents discuss Benjamin, the child who hit the other boy with a stick.
I'm sure your son is not a savage. Of course Benjamin isn't a savage.
Yes, he is.
That's absurd, Alan. Why say something like that?
He's a savage.
How does he explain his behavior?
He doesn't want to discuss it.
He ought to discuss it.
He ought to do any number of things. He ought to come here. He ought to discuss it. He ought to be sorry for it. Clearly, you have parenting skills that put us to shame.
I feel like everyone I know who's a mother has to defend the way that she raises her child. And I think a lot of women judge each other. And I think that Annette is somebody who wants so desperately to be accepted by another mother. And she's clearly done a bad job. So I think there's just that desperation to defend your way of doing things. And I think that when it comes to children, I think that's the one thing that everyone has an opinion about before you even get the baby out of you. It's like the most opinions you can have about somebody is how they have children and what they do with their children.
The basic premise of couples turning on each other is as old as Punch and Judy. And it's, you know, the honeymooners on the low end, on the
exactly.
cultural low end, mm-hmm. and it's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on the high end. And yet Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was much scarier. This gets funnier. Do you get to shade it?
As an audience member, you can do that, or a reader. But as an actor, if I would just start thinking about, oh, maybe we're sort of like the couple that visits George and Martha, you know, and then I'm thinking about the wrong thing. But as an audience member, as a reader of it, certainly, you know, don't you immediately think of Virginia Woolf?
A little of To the Moon, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all of it. Like you said, it's as old as time.
My son lost two teeth, two incisors.
Yes, I think we all got that.
One of them for good.
He'll get new ones. We'll give him new ones, better ones. Sometimes if he burst an eardrum.
Don't you all feel like you've either wanted to or have said things like that in your life? You know, especially wanted to. Towards the end, you know. But, you know, there are places where what you might say in private about, like, if we had gone home, if we ever got out of that apartment, you know, if we had gone home, we'd get into the car and immediately go, Jesus Christ, you know, like, we just happened to do it right to their faces.
Well, you know, Ty Burr, in reviewing the movie, said that you either laugh uncontrollably or you start laughing in recognition. You know, and he said, oh, we all know people like this, you know, they're at the PTA or maybe they're in the mirror.
Yep.
Do you feel that from the audience?
The audience, it seems like they feel freedom. Like, it's like, that's just unbelievable that they said that. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of freeing. And there's also, you know, we hear a lot of,
ooh. Yeah, right.
I think the first moment you really hear the audience go, oh, thank you for saying that, is when Stephen does his Neanderthal speech.
I am up to here with these idiotic discussions. We tried to be nice. We bought tulips. My wife passed me off as a liberal, but I can't keep this up anymore. I am not a member of polite society. What I am, and always have been, is a Neanderthal.
I feel like so many people can identify with his, I can't
put up this, you know, facade of being a member of polite society.
And a liberal.
And a, like, yeah, fake liberal.
The dirtiest word in the English worst, language. Yes, like,
this is a public radio audience.
In the end, the couple seem like exhausted boxers hanging onto the ropes. The visiting couple, the Raleighs, threaten to leave for the upteenth time, but they keep coming back for more. There's no knockout punch, as there isn't Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Our audience wondered what could possibly come next. So did the actors.
Isn't that the most fascinating thing about the play? Like, what happens next?
Yeah.
How do the Raleighs get out of that house? And what do they decide to do with their kids?
Yeah. I guess at some point the kids will be home from school and they'll clean us up and put us to bed.
Tell me why you're